your immediate support. Shorten the drive today. Call 818-985-5735 and press option 2. That's 818-985-5735, option 2. Or skip the phone lines and give securely online right now at kpfk.org/donate. Your radio station. Your voice. Keep it strong. Thank you.
KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse coalition of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage.
I'm Jessica Partnow, your guest host. And this week, we are honoring the legacy of an incredible person that we lost in November of 2025.
Hi, my name is Alice Wong, and I was selected as a community storytelling fellow at Making Contact.
In 2015, Alice Wong was part of a storytelling fellowship program here at Making Contact, where she got to learn and practice audio storytelling skills and produced a radio story.
I'm excited to create a story about the lives of people with disabilities who use personal assistants and their relationships with their home care providers. People with disabilities are usually the subject of a radio story, but rarely is the person creating the story disabled as well. Representation on both sides matters.
Alice was an activist and an advocate. She was a MacArthur Fellow. She was appointed by President Obama to serve on the National Council on Disability. She founded the Disability Visibility Project and published work in dozens of publications, from the New York Times to Making Contact. The nation called her the first disabled public intellectual. She was only 51 when she died. Her time at Making Contact came relatively early in her rise to public intellectual status. Let's start the episode off by listening to the story Alice produced as a community storytelling fellow here at Making Contact. The first voice you'll hear is Camille. She works as a personal assistant for people with disabilities.
The minute I walked through the door, her name was Gladys. Her face would light up and she'd be so happy. Come on, Camille, this is what we're doing today. We're going to do this, that, and the other. And we would map out our day. I clean the house, get everything done, get her bathed, lay out her clothes for the day. This is what you can wear, this. And I drive her to do whatever it was she needed to do.
Camille Christian is an in-home care provider. Bathing, feeding, dressing, cleaning are among a laundry list of daily living activities involved in long-term care work. It's labor-intensive. You're also seeing someone in their most intimate moments. Home care worker Brenda Jackson says her clients are like family.
As a matter of fact, I call her Aunt Mary. So she's part of my family now. So that's why it's important for me to make sure she's happy and she's comfortable and she's in her own home.
Christian says that it's also a matter of dignity.
Everybody needs to feel that they have their own self-respect, that they have their own dignity. And it makes me feel good to know that I'm helping someone have that.
That dignity depends on a balanced, healthy relationship between those receiving care and those giving. So how do we ensure quality care for both, especially as demand for care work is expected to grow? By 2030, the number of senior citizens is projected to double to 72.1 million. As more seniors move into older age brackets, the demand for a younger generation of workers and family members to help with day-to-day life will increase too. A UC San Francisco study estimates at least 2.5 million more workers are needed to fill the long-term care gap. For workers, fair wages, employment protections, job growth, and training are some ways to ensure sustainability in the industry, according to the study's author, Joanne Spetz. Whether you're a paid home care provider or rely on personal assistance to meet your daily needs, or a family member caring for a loved one, the nature of the working relationship banks on mutual respect and dignity. On this edition of Making Contact, we'll explore the dynamic and complex relationship of care receiving and giving, Community Storytelling Fellow Alice Wong asks, how do people with disabilities who rely on personal assistance negotiate their relationships with the people that assist them? And how does that inform their sense of independence or interdependence with others? In this next story from the San Francisco Bay Area, Wong searches for answers.
Hey, Bob, I'm ready to get up.
See the helmet?
Oh, not too bad.
Okay.
Can you turn off the oxygen?
Okay.
I don't want to get up. But here I am, in bed, needing to get up and get in my wheelchair. From the minute I wake up, I'm connected to people. Can't get away from it, even if I wanted to. Kenzie Roby is an artist in San Francisco who has multiple people that work for him. Like me, he's in bed when his attendant arrives.
I have no use of my legs, so I'm very dependent on care providers. So when someone comes in the morning, the first thing they need to do, wash their hands. Wash their hands, get gloves, and then check and be sure I'm clean. And I can't urinate unless someone inserts a catheter inside my bladder, and I need to do that several times a day.
When you need help with almost every aspect of your life, it changes the way you relate to others. I got a chance to talk with some of my disabled friends in the Bay Area, exploring their relationships with people who help them with their daily activities. Kenzie says it's different each time he trains a new attendant.
And I've had people that are able to be directed and able to be taught the procedure within 30 minutes or 2 hours. And I've had other people who feel like, well, why are you picking on me? Why do I have to change my gloves? You're wasting material. And I have to tell them that the gloves are disposable. I'm not.
Some people have spouses and family members as their attendants, whether they're paid or unpaid. Ingrid Tischer lives in Berkeley with her husband. Here's their typical morning.
When we get up, he's the person in the household who sort of gets the day started by making the coffee, starting the breakfast. And I sleep at night using a BiPAP machine.
A BiPAP machine helps a person breathe.
So I get up and sort of take care of that. This is funny. But I would say in the time that I've been married, it's probably been the first time in my adult life when I could wear pretty much anything I want or do something with my hair without it being a big deal. And he can help me button things, pull things on, zip things, and then like tie my hair back if I want. And he's really good-natured about it, the way, you know, it makes it nice.
Love your hair.
Oh, another Berkeley resident, Alana Terrio, has been living independently for 34 years. She employs 6 attendants and extra backup workers for shifts throughout the week. They go where she goes, including the home and out in the community.
I hate driving on the freeway, but they're all very good sports and drive me where I need to go. And then bring me home, set me up with a snack, help me open my mail, do whatever paperwork in the house, make dinner. And they leave at 6 p.m. And at that point, I have a little downtime, which is nice.
Having privacy can be hard when you need assistance often.
I don't have enough alone time now. I have the care hours that I need. And that's fabulous, but at the same time, I don't have the alone time that I miss. I miss that now.
Anyone who uses personal assistance is part director, choreographer, and actor. Patty Byrne is the director of Sins Invalid, a performing arts group in Berkeley. She compares her work to how she gets her needs met.
Like, seriously, people are like, where do you get such skills? And I'm like, well, what it takes me to get dressed every day? Like, that is a production. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I can manage, like, a show, you know? Because, like, I produce an event every day when I'm dressed and, you know, fed.
That's
and
choreography, right?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Being disabled and using personal assistance isn't a solo act. It's an ensemble production where relationships are the key to a successful show. Mom, can you make me some coffee now?
Okay.
One pivotal scene in my daily drama is how I gotta have my coffee every afternoon when working from home. Since I can't make it myself and I'm picky about my coffee, I communicate clearly and supervise my mom, who's one of my attendants. My addiction to coffee is at stake, and it must be satisfied.
Thanks, Mom.
You're welcome.
For Alana, it's all about teamwork.
I try to foster relationships between the workers. It's nice because usually I have 2 to 3 days of training, and then maybe 1 or 2 attendants involved in that training. So right off the bat, they meet each other. And I'll encourage them to say, I don't know, maybe we should call so-and-so, find out how we deal with this problem. Or I encourage them to call each other when they need a sub, so it's not just all on email.
There are a lot of ways disabled people express their thanks to their attendants. Showing gratitude can go a long way.
Once a year, I host an attendant appreciation dinner where we go out. And as I build relationships with them, they care about me, and I care about them.
Care is involved in the work of personal assistants, but it's impossible to ignore the power dynamics. Rachel Stewart, who lives and works in Alameda, describes the give-and-take nature of the relationship.
I think I'm still learning, and I think that, like you said, it's a very fine line, but it's kind of like also letting people know when, like, the line has been crossed. It's like, okay, like, I really need you to be on time because I'm going to pee my pants unless you're here on time. Mm-hmm. You know, like, just being really frank and upfront mm-hmm. with people is really important, and being honest, but also, like, showing your appreciation and, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a hard one to navigate.
Yeah. Navigating these boundaries can be tricky, especially if your attendant is also your family member. Ingrid describes the understanding she has with her husband, Ken.
I don't ever have to be concerned, for example, that one of us is going to use our argument to sort of get back at the other one in the course of assisting, usually me, with something. And I think it's important for the health of the relationship because at some point, Ken is going to need help from me more than he does now. And I think if we have a foundation of knowing what each other's limits are and what we will not transgress, that's what the health of the relationship is built on.
Appreciation, trust, communication, and a shared sense of responsibility can keep relationships strong between attendants and disabled people. Keeping balance between your actions and your politics is another vital aspect. Patty recalls a time when she supported her attendant.
You know, one of my attendants, unfortunately, she recently broke her wrist. And rather than being like, okay, you're disposable, I'm just going to hire somebody else, I hired an assistant for her mm-hmm. to help with the pieces of the routine that she couldn't do anymore, because that makes sense, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, it's just, you know, how do we meet our needs collectively, you know? And it's really cool because these nuances of movement that she didn't realize I was contributing to the routine, now that she's doing one-handed, mm-hmm. she's like seeing things, oh, yeah, actually, right. Like Patty's supporting her own balance.
So for Patty, this is an example of disability justice in action. Communities can create collective access, and no one is disposable. Jessica Lehman is the executive director of Senior Disability
action in San Francisco. She tells me when she first connected disability justice with domestic workers' rights.
What happens at my home is, you know, a little piece of that big picture that I'm talking about and that I have really committed my life to. And it just felt like the best example of the personal is political and of what an opportunity I have to learn and to live my values, to tie together what I care about, you know, to bring the values that I put out into the world to really feel that in my own body and in my own home, and to be able to work on that with other people.
Hey, Mom. I'm ready to go to bed now.
Okay,
yeah. Can you turn off my hospital bed? Can you turn on the oxygen, please? Well, it's time for me to go to bed. As my mom turns on my oxygen machine and my air mattress, I'll leave you with these final thoughts. Disabled people and their attendants are both vulnerable and resilient. Our relationships and well-being are linked. How we treat each other is a reflection of the kind of world we want to live in. Our labor has value. We are stronger together. For the Binky Contact Storytelling Fellowship, I'm Alice Wong.
I'm Jessica Partnow. This week we are celebrating the life and legacy of Alice Wong. I personally only really got to know Alice's work a few years ago. My husband became disabled in 2020, and overnight we found ourselves living in a completely different world. You know, we could just get trapped on a block where there wasn't a curb cut. Suddenly we couldn't go over to most of our friends' houses because they all had stairs. When he talks, people will be sure that they just can't understand him because his voice doesn't sound like what they're expecting. People will talk to me about him like he's just not there. It can be really lonely. So when I found the company of Alice's writing, her openness and vulnerability, her fiery frustration, it was a big relief just to understand that we weren't alone and that we were very, very much not alone. Many, many people were living with these kind of experiences and had been for a long time and had been working as activists and advocates in this space for many years before it entered my life so personally. And Alice wrote about this as part of her storytelling fellowship here at Making Contact. She wrote a piece called Diversifying Radio with Disabled Voices, talking about some of the ableism that is very, very present in this field. You can find the full essay at our website, focmedia.org. It is a wonderful piece. I really encourage you to read it. And I want to read an excerpt of it here called The Story of My Voice. I love this section of the piece because it's coming from the perspective of a person with vocal difference. I wish that we could be listening to Alice's voice read this, but I will try to do her beautiful writing justice with my voice. Story of My Voice, an excerpt of an essay by Alice Wong. In 2015, I started becoming interested in radio as a result of a community partnership I formed with StoryCorps, focused on recording the stories of people with disabilities. I had concerns about people who would be excluded from participation due to the oddest nature of oral histories. As I figured out ways to provide options and access for people who communicate visually or nonverbally, I thought more about the medium of radio and whether disabled lives, voices, and bodies are considered part of the public media landscape. I have a neuromuscular disease called spinal muscular atrophy. This is a progressive condition where all the muscles in the body slowly weaken over time. My body's changed over the 40-something years of my life. I transitioned from walking to using a walker, to a manual wheelchair, electric wheelchair, customized wheelchair. Throughout this process, I learned to adjust. Over time, I required more assistance, coming in the form of personal assistance, technology, or services. Even with a healthy set of lungs, my lung function has steadily declined since I turned 18 because of my weakening diaphragm muscles that are responsible for the act of breathing. In fact, I had a medical crisis when I went into respiratory failure due to sleep apnea. My diaphragm needed support, and that's when I started using non-invasive ventilation. I became Darth Vader. A BiPAP machine provides ventilatory support. That is, the BiPAP pushes breaths of air into a person's lungs at a set rate and volume. These breaths enter the body through a tube and mask. It's a lifesaver and something I'll use for the rest of my life. I'm now in a phase of my life where I use the BiPAP during the day. This started about 2 years ago and is now the norm. Using the BiPAP in the day meant a lot of changes and adjustment. I have a machine by my bed and one that I can carry on the back of my wheelchair. The one on my wheelchair has a battery, something that is invaluable and facilitates my ability to be in the community. As I attend meetings and gatherings, I noticed a difference in the way people related to me. I have to repeat myself because people can't understand me. If a breath is coming in right in the middle of speech, I have to pause, leaving these unnatural and awkward speech patterns. When I talk too long when using my mask, I tend to salivate a lot and need to pause to swallow. This can be especially frustrating if I'm in public spaces, trying to order something at a cafe or asking a question to someone at Trader Joe's. I find myself having to suppress the feeling of being self-conscious and embarrassed at my vocal difference. A big part of my identity, ego, and self-image is centered on my voice and writing. I had to confront my discomfort and accept my new sound and body that has become even more cyborg-like as time goes on. I had to regain my sense of pride, and that only happens through practice. To paraphrase Laura Hershey's poem, "You Get Proud by Practicing," March 1991. Even with my politicized disability identity, I have to remind myself that the problem isn't located in my body, but society and my own internalized ableism. I also have to remember I'm not alone and I'm part of a large community of disabled people with vocal differences. Radio, like any cultural institution, enforces normalcy. This normalcy is centered on the ability to hear and speak well. With the exception of community radio that features shows by disabled people, e.g. Pushing Limits on KPFA, Disability Matters on Voice America, and podcasts, you don't hear a lot of people that sound different due to disability on public radio, except for Diane Rehm. It's time for people in radio to think critically about messages they are transmitting by excluding certain voices and lived experiences. Symphonic disabled voices. On radio, I want to hear people who lisp, stutter, gurgle, stammer, wheeze, repeat themselves, pause when needing to breathe, make noises when they talk, salivate and drool, communicate, enunciate, and pronounce differently, use different speech patterns and rhythms, use ventilators or other assistive technology. Use sign language interpreters or other people that facilitate speech. Use computer-generated speech. I want to disrupt what's thought of as the default public radio voice. I want to challenge listeners as they ride the subway, jog on their treadmills, drive on their commute. Even if the sounds and words we create might require greater concentration and attention. That was an excerpt from Alice Wong's essay, Diversifying Radio with Disabled Voices. You can read the full piece at focmedia.org. In that essay, Alice mentions a poem by Laura Hershey called You Get Proud by Practicing, written in 1991. And we're so lucky that Alice recorded herself reading it. So here it is, Alice Wong reading You Get Proud by Practicing, a poem by Laura Hershey.
If you are not proud for who you are, for what you say, for how you look, if every time you stop to think of yourself, you do not see yourself glowing with golden light, Do not, therefore, give up on yourself. You did get proud. You did not need a better body, a pure spirit, or a PhD to be proud. You do not need a lot of money, to have a boyfriend, or a nice car. You do not need to be able to walk, nor see or hear, nor use big, complicated words, nor do any of the things that you just can't do to be proud. A caseworker cannot make you proud, or a doctor. You only need more practice. You get proud by practicing. There are many ways to get proud. You can try riding a horse, or skiing on one leg, or play guitar, and do well or not so well, and be glad you tried either way. You can show something you've made to someone you respect, and be happy with it no matter what they say. You say what you think, though you know other people do not think the same way. And you just keep saying it, even if they tell you you're crazy. You can add your voice all night to the voices of 150 others in a circle around a jailhouse. Or your brothers and sisters are being held. For blocking buses with no lift. Or you could be one of those ones inside the jailhouse. Knowing of the circle outside. Did you speak your love to a friend without fear? Did you find someone who will listen to you? Without judging you or doubting you? Or being afraid of you? To let you hear yourself, perhaps for the first time. These are all ways of getting proud. None of them are easy, but all of them are possible. Do you do all of these things? Or just one of them again and again? Do you get proud by practicing? Power makes you proud. That power comes in many fine forms, supple and rich, as butterfly wings. It is music when you practice, opening your mouth and liking what you hear, because it is the sound of your own true voice. It is sunlight when you practice, seeing strength and beauty in everyone, including yourself. It is dance when you practice knowing that what you do and the way you do it is the right way for you. It can't be called wrong. All of these hold more power than the weapons or money or lies. All these practices bring power, and power makes you proud. You get proud by practicing. Remember, you weren't the one who made you ashamed, but you are the one who can make you proud. Just practice. Practice until you get proud. Then once you are proud, keep practicing so you won't forget. You get proud by practicing.
Thank you to Alice Wong for a lifetime of getting proud by practicing. Rest in power. Thanks for listening. I'm Jessica Partnow.
benefits of donating your used vehicle to KPFK include funding new and existing programming, as well as increasing community awareness. You also benefit by being able to reduce your taxable income. There's no need to deal with the hassles of selling it, and you support public radio in the process. To donate your vehicle, please call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM.
We take a look at one of the most prolific Mexican artists, Frida Kahlo, through the lens of our friends at En Confianza with Pulso Podcast. Frida Kahlo's painted self-portraits have gained widespread recognition around the world. Younger generations continue to proudly lift up Frida as a symbol of unapologetic feminism and artistic freedom. And while Frida Kahlo's art has been widely popularized and even commercialized, it still represents bold self-determination and strength in the face of crushing patriarchy. Up next, we hear from producer Anthony Wallace about the story of Tanya Betancourt Alcazar, a member of the art group The Phoenix Fridas, who discovered a lifeline in the art of Frida Kahlo by embracing Frida's artistic message of resilience and empowerment. Tanya would later find the inner strength to confront her own traumas and transform her pain into art.
Tanya Betancourt Alcazar made a big choice in her mid-20s.
I decided to be child-free by choice because I think that's my authenticity, like me saying, hey, I love children, but they're not for me.
In her world, this was a radical decision, and she was afraid to tell anyone about it.
All the women in my family have had children, so I'm kind of making my own path.
And in 2019, she was on a trip to LA with a new group of friends. They were in their hotel room crafting and painting together the night before ConchaCon, an art festival dedicated to the brightly colored Mexican pastries. And there she decided it was time to get the child-free thing off her chest.
And they were the first women that I shared with that I wanted to be child-free, when I hadn't even shared that with my family. And I'm sorry I'm getting choked up, but just to hear them, like, listen to my decision, and then for them to, like, be mothers and following a different path than I was, but still saying, hey, I support you and I back you, and they're not trying to change my mind, that meant the world to me.
That moment of deep empathy, of rebellion against cultural norms, it reflects the person that brought them all together. Her friends at the hotel that night were her fellow Phoenix Fridas, a Latina art collective dedicated to and named after the great Mexican artist Frida Kahlo. Most people, if they know Frida Kahlo at all, only know her face. But Tanya and her fellow Phoenix Fridas have considered her life and art much more deeply, and it's had a profound effect on them. Tanya was born in Mexico, moved to the U.S. as a small child, and when she started school, she didn't know English. She was timid, shy, and afraid to rock the boat.
That's something maybe I wanted to be more like, is like express myself more. As a kid, I felt like I couldn't express myself the way I wanted to. And I love that Frida Kahlo would do that. She would express herself and she didn't really care what people thought of her.
Frida Kahlo was courageous, defiant, bluntly honest, a fierce defender of the underdog and a powerful political activist. Behind Frida's famous unibrow is an inspiring, historic, and provocative story with the power to change lives.
Frida's work inspired me to be unapologetic, to be, honestly, a disruptor. Frida did whatever she wanted to, not as long as it made her happy, but as long as she was true to herself.
As a teenager, Frida Kahlo was physically impaled by a steel beam and broke her spine in a bus accident, and her body never really healed. She was in constant pain and constant need of surgery. She needed more than 30 over the course of her life. But she never stopped living, dancing, painting, and pushing boundaries, sometimes in bed with a cane or in a full torso cast. She wore a men's suit in a formal family photo in the 1920s, and she was shamelessly bisexual before that term was really a thing. She studied biology, philosophy, and history at the top prep school in Mexico, where she was one of only a few dozen girls in a student body of 2,000. She found her own way into the upper echelons of the Mexican Communist Party, where she got to know her husband, the legendary painter Diego Rivera. Together, they housed the Marxist revolutionary Leon Trotsky, as Stalinist agents threatened to scale their walls to murder him. Diego's lucrative murals led them to the United States, where they dined and drank with the Rockefellers and Fords, and used their power to subvert them. Diego painted Karl Marx at Rockefeller Center, and Frida mocked the Nazi-sympathizing Henry Ford to his face at a crowded dinner table. Two of the people Frida loved the most, Diego and her younger sister Christina, had an extended affair. She was broken physically, betrayed cruelly, and belittled by the press and the art world, not taken seriously as a painter in her own right. But she took all of her persistence, intellect, eye for beauty, and bloody pain and infused it into her art. Her paintings are attention-grabbing, sometimes shocking, but always deeply thought-provoking. Tanya found Frida when she was a shy kid who felt she didn't belong. Now she's a multimedia artist and communications coordinator for a nonprofit that is working to give power to marginalized communities. She's colorfully, passionately, and courageously fighting for what she believes in, just like Frida did. For Tanya and many others like her, Frida Kahlo is a source of not only inspiration, but power. From Frida Kahlo and the Phoenix Fridas, Tanya found the courage to be authentic. But what she didn't know, crafting in that hotel room in LA with her newest and closest confidants, is that tragedy would soon strike the Fridas, and she would need all of the resilience and courage she could muster to get through it. Today, Frida is everywhere. On thousands and thousands of products, t-shirts, tote bags, there's even a Frida Kahlo emoji set and a strangely light-skinned Frida Kahlo Barbie doll.
Frida Kahlo. Her work and her story inspires me every day.
But despite the fact that Frida's been dead for nearly 70 years, her mega fame is a relatively recent phenomenon.
I first encountered her in an art history classroom in the 1980s. And that time, she was not well known at all in the United States. And I thought, this is one powerful, powerful woman.
This is Celia Starr, an art historian at the University of San Francisco and the author of Frida in America, The Creative Awakening of a Great Artist. Frida died in the 1950s, and for a while after her death, she was pretty obscure. Then, in the early 80s, a major biography about her hit the shelves and she started to pop up in mainstream culture. During her life, Frida sold paintings for less than $200. In the 70s, you could buy one for $40,000. By 1990, they were going for well over $1 million.
I'm starting to see in the 90s, it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And I really thought we had reached a point of saturation.
The Frida face t-shirts multiplied. People talked about Frida mania. But when it seemed like she couldn't get any bigger, she did.
Behind the madness lies the mystery of one of the most seductive and most intriguing women of ours or any time.
To Frida!
To Frida!
Frida.
And then, of course, we have the movie Frida come out based on the biography. And then Salma Hayek really brings her to another level of fame in the United States.
The movie made over $50 million at the box office and sent Frida mania into full swing. When it came out, Tanya was 10 years old.
I didn't know much about Frida until the movie. My mom and I watched it, and it was like the first time we saw representation of our country, our culture, right? Like on the big screen.
At the time, Tanya and her mom hadn't been in the U.S. for very long.
I was born in Mexico, in Chihuahua, Mexico, and then my mom first came out to the United States, and then I followed. So, I was 3 years old, so I'm very proud Mexican-American.
At first, they lived in San Francisco, where Tanya's mom met who had become her stepdad. He was an immigrant himself from Guatemala. Together, they made a lively household.
Like, my dad's side was more like merengue and cumbia. My mom's side was a little bit more rancheras and Selena. So it was two different worlds, but I am so glad that I grew up in that.
But of course, the transition to a new country was difficult, especially when Tanya started school.
I grew up knowing Spanish at home, speaking Spanish at home, and then having to switch to English in school was tough at first because I didn't know the language. I was definitely very shy as a kid. I moved schools often, so I was always the new kid. I dealt with bullying, you know, so I always relate with outcasts. I relate with them because I feel like I was an outcast. I found solace in like Harry Potter because he was an outcast as well. Very different, strange child.
Frida was also a strange child, often forced into isolation. When she was six, she got polio, which left her with one skinny leg and a lifelong limp. And when she was 18, the wooden bus she was riding home was shattered in a violent collision with a trolley car. Her spinal column, ribs, collarbone, pelvis, and right leg were broken. A steel handrail impaled her, piercing her abdomen, damaging her uterus, and exiting out her groin. Doctors expected her to die. But, as she would do throughout her life, she defied expectations. From that point on, she spent weeks and months at a time alone, debilitated and confined to bed. She developed a deep affinity for the forgotten people, the poor, the Harry Potters, and the outcasts of the world. Here's Frida expert Celia Starr again.
Frida was somebody who was always for the underdog. You know, she was dealing with physical disabilities. And as a bisexual woman, she often was marginalized.
But the accident didn't just make Frida more empathetic. It ultimately energized her and made her the Frida Kahlo we know today. She got a special easel that was connected to her bed, and she started painting. Frida painted a self-portrait called The Broken Column. In it, her torso is split in half vertically, and a crumbling Roman column is in the place of her spine. Nails puncture her skin all over her body, and tears fall from her eyes. But her expression is stoic. Growing up, Tanya also found solace in honest artistic expression.
I would just like draw and doodle. And then also I like to document my life too, like diaries, which is also a form of being creative. I feel like I've been a multi-passionate creative all my life, sewing, photography, video. So yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Tanya's family moved to Phoenix. Her parents had two more kids, her little sisters, and she grew up. She started a YouTube channel with her husband and did some work as a photographer. She kept coming out of her shell and pushing the limits of her self-expression. But still, in her mid-20s, she felt like she was missing the close group of friends she never made in school.
I have a very traumatic history of having female friends in my life. You know, I went through bullying and things like that. So I think 2017 was the year that I really wanted to be surrounded by creative women, have like female friends more in my life.
And that's where Mo came in.
My husband's friend, who became my friend, Mo, her name Monique, she was working at Tres Leches Cafe. She hit up Jose and she was like, hey, I saw your channel and I wish you could like do a feature on our cafe.
We're checking out this Mexican gourmet cafe, which is located in Central Phoenix.
Yeah, so we're really excited. You guys are gonna love this place. It's awesome.
Yeah.
They went to visit and vlog at Tres Leches, and Tanya met Mo, who was a Phoenix Frida. At that point, the Fridas had been around for over a decade. They were a tight-knit group and highly respected in the Phoenix art scene. They didn't let new people in all the time, but Mo saw something in Tanya.
From that point on, we just started talking. Like, she saw my videos. Mo said that I should join the Phoenix Fridas, so they brought me on, and I have friends for life. Like, I was honestly so happy just to be a part of a creative group and that they recognized and saw that I was a creative woman in the community too. So I felt really honored by that.
The group put on joint art shows, threw an annual birthday party for Frida, did a pilgrimage to Frida's house in Mexico City, and talked a lot about Frida's work together. The conversations brought them all closer to each other and closer to Frida. And they made Tanya bolder and more confident.
I created one of her self-portraits where she chopped off all her hair. And my rebellion was that I dyed my hair blue because my mom would always be like, oh, those are like crazy colors, you know? So for me, that was my rebellion.
One of the best new friends she made in the group was Luisa Leon, who was just a few years older than her.
You know, Luisa, she had very colorful hair. Like, I related with her in that. And she was very colorful, just like her paintings.
Luisa was there when Tanya told the group about her plans to be child-free.
She would tell me, she's like, I feel like you're a mom already. You are a nurturer. So she saw things in me that I didn't see.
Luisa, Mo, and the rest of the Phoenix Fridas quickly became Tanya's friends, confidants, and motivators. As they pushed her to become herself and be fearless creatively, she developed a pretty radical approach to social media, especially with her autobiographical second-a-day videos.
I started to not only turn the camera toward me, but also turn the camera toward myself when I wasn't at my highest point of feeling the best I could be. And that is very similar to Frida. She documented a lot of her pain, her suffering. A lot of my 1 seconds do have that. Like, they show when I'm crying or show when I've been distressed. Social media, in a way, is a form of art, right? Expression of, like, what is going on in your life. So I think when I started being really raw and honest and documenting my life, at least on social media, I would get people in the DMs and be like, I completely feel the way you do.
In her 1 second videos, she cries, dances, goes to concerts and does Zoom meetings. She sews, lays in bed, makes coffee, and hangs with her family. Recently, she's been kicking pads and playing games in karate class, alongside a bunch of elementary school kids. In one post, she opens up about being child-free by choice. In another, about her insecurity about being a light-skinned Latina. Her honesty is attention-grabbing. The posts start conversations about taboo things people would normally keep inside.
How did it, like, feel to be having these conversations?
I definitely felt I wasn't alone anymore. I didn't feel as isolated as I felt, especially, like, in the height of the pandemic, going through, you know, depression, going through just so many things, losing people in my life. I think I didn't feel as alone.
When the pandemic shut things down in 2020, the Phoenix Fridas did what they could to continue bringing color and life into the world, even remotely. Tanya did a special quarantine photo series, and her friend Luisa did Instagram live painting lessons for 100 consecutive nights. And it even got some news coverage.
She started painting lives with Luisa mid-March and has quickly gained momentum.
It started with having about 5 people watching me. Until now, which is over 100 people every night tuning in. This experience for me has just reinstated what I always wanted to know, which was my purpose in life. And I think my purpose is to get other people to just create for themselves and just have fun doing it.
But on top of the same isolation and fear of the virus that we all felt, Tanya was forced to stare at all of 2020's horrible news all day long. She was a layout designer for a major newspaper company, and it was taking a toll on her mental health. And making things worse, her employer restricted her from responding to the news with her usual passion and honesty.
When George Floyd happened, the, you know, Black Lives Matter demonstrations happened, you couldn't go and, like, hold a sign or nothing like that. That would be, like, under violation. So I was, like, fed up. I felt, you know, like I couldn't express myself the way I wanted to.
So she turned to her fellow Fridas, Luisa specifically.
I was, like, telling her that I hate my job. She's like, let's get you a better job. She really pushed me.
With Luisa motivating her, Tanya got serious about finding a new job. But about a year into the pandemic, tragedy hit the Fridas. Mo was just 42 years old. But Tanya said she had psoriasis and it took a bad turn during quarantine.
It was February 2021. Mo had been struggling with her health and her organs weren't working on by themselves anymore. So she unfortunately passed away. She was very young, you know, still. You know, I went to her funeral and some of the Fridas went, some of us, you know, we're still very in the deep of the pandemic, so it was hard, right?
Just a couple months later, Luisa, who was just 33, came down with COVID.
In July, we got the news that she had gotten COVID, and then, you know, we prayed for her. We thought she was going to be out of it, you know, just given her age. The following month, she was gone.
Luisa Leon died in August of COVID-19, and she inspired many people during this pandemic as she taught hundreds of people how to paint online. And she did this for 100 days straight during quarantine, reaching people all over the world.
It's just very, very sudden. And it was very hard for all of us. You know, I still remember us being like in a room and just crying. It's just, she really motivated me. She was very unapologetic, something I always admired about her. She always would see the bright side in things. She just found a way to like bring light into darkness. And I really miss her. She meant a lot to me.
With Luisa's encouragement and help, Tanya did get that new job.
She was always like motivating me, and I never got to tell her that I got a new job. I never got to tell her. And I know she's with me. Like, I'm even looking at that sticker on my water bottle, and she had blue hair, you know, and I know she shows up for me. Whenever I want to feel bold or unapologetic, I always try to channel her. I really miss her. I really miss both her and Mo.
2021 for Tanya was a seemingly relentless barrage of emotional pain.
I think two things got me through difficult times. One was family and friends. And then two, I think I really found solace in my sewing machine. I would sew a lot. I would make things for friends. And I would just sit there and listen to podcasts or listen to music. And I would just make things, you know.
And always by her sewing machine is a little picture of Frida Kahlo.
Yeah, that postcard I got in Ciudad de Mexico. And I always have her there as like inspiration.
And she found purpose in the new job that Luisa inspired her to get.
I am a marketing and communications coordinator. I work for an organization called Instituto. It's based here in Arizona. It's an organization that helps build political infrastructure with low income and communities of color here in the state.
During these last term elections, she even knocked on doors and helped get a bill passed that allows DACA recipients who live in Arizona to get in-state tuition rates for college. And this political work, Tanya also sees as following in Frida's footsteps.
She was fighting for the working class. And then also, like, her sexuality, too. Like, she was very outspoken about that as well.
Yes, she was, you know, she was a very political person. She was interested in communism early on before she meets Diego Rivera. Oftentimes, you know, people say, oh, it's because of Diego that she got interested in communism. Not true. I mean, she called herself a child of the revolution.
Frida sometimes shifted her birth year from 1907 to 1910, the year of the peasant-led Mexican Revolution. Together, Diego and Frida helped create a new Mexican culture and national identity, magnifying the poor, indigenous, and working people of Mexico.
By the time she gets to the United States, and it's 1933, she's seen a lot. You know, she has seen the people who can't afford to eat lined up on streets and waiting, you know, to just get some soup. But then at the same time, she's hobnobbing with, you know, the Rockefellers. And there you have, you know, the exact opposite.
She wanted authenticity, raw beauty, to stick up for the outcast and to expose hypocrisy. Frida loved MoMA and the jazz clubs in Harlem. Her paintings showed black protesters in New York and dystopian smokestack landscapes in Detroit. At one dinner party hosted by the mogul Henry Ford, an anti-Semite who Hitler praised in Mein Kampf, Frida played dumb. At a lull in the conversation, she asked, "Mr. Ford, are you Jewish?" There was an awkward silence and then an uproar of laughter.
She was incredibly bold for her time period, but she's still bold today. I mean, that's what's amazing, right? Is that the unibrow, for example, is still bold.
After they lost Mo and Luisa, the Phoenix Fridas retired the group after 18 years.
Having the passing of our members too felt like a chapter closing. Like it kind of felt odd to continue without them. And I think the group had accomplished its purpose of bringing joy and love of Frida into Phoenix.
Frida Kahlo and the Phoenix Fridas made their mark and changed their world. Tanya was once timid and bullied. Now she's courageously and creatively asserting herself, saying what others are afraid to. And while she was once new to the U.S., unable to speak English, she's now a political force, making her mark on the country. And as she's evolved, she's become more like her hero she first saw on a Hollywood movie. And the ripples of freedom mania are still flowing out everywhere. Yes, there is something ironic about Frida as a brand, given her feelings about capitalism. But even when you only see that unibrow out of context, it leaves an impression. Every Frida bag, every Frida drink or pair of socks, is just another chance for someone to pause and wonder, who is that person really?
Frida is a gateway to Mexican culture. And she's not just a flower crown. She was political. Everything about her, her struggles was like intersectional, right? Her disability, her politics, her sexuality. You have to take all parts of her, not just cherry pick. And I think she creates conversation to this day. And that's what I really love about her is that she creates, she's still stirring up drama, you know, she's still stirring up controversy. And I think that's just, that's her. That's her.
When she was 47, Frida's always tenuous health took a turn for the worse, and she came down with a bad case of pneumonia. Still in July of 1954, she summoned what little life she had left and took to the streets of Mexico City by wheelchair to protest the CIA's intervention in Guatemala. Less than 2 weeks later, her funeral procession went down the same city streets. As Frida's body was pushed into the crematorium, a strange thermodynamic phenomenon took place. The dead artist suddenly sprung into an upright position, her hair on fire and her mouth apparently smiling. Even her dead body defied limitations as it arose and glowed with an infectious energy. And her power and influence continues to grow, making new generations of determined, bold fighters for life and defiers of limitation. The year before she died, she had to have her leg amputated. In her diary, she wrote, "Feet, what do I need them for if I have wings to fly?"
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Marcy Winograd. Code Pink Radio is a weekly anti-war radio show produced by Code Pink, a women-led grassroots peace organization focused on ending U.S. wars, building a peace economy, and promoting human rights. Code Pink Radio features global grassroots activists discussing and offering practical steps for activism and inspiring stories of peace and resistance. That's Code Pink Radio Fridays at 6 a.m. right here on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. We'll make peace. Together we'll make
peace. In a world filled with corporate media, predictable sound bites, and endless commercials, there's still a place for independent truth. That place is KPFK. And on Tuesday, July 21st, our summer fun drive officially begins. We know you tune in for the hard-hitting news, deep cultural insights, and music you won't hear anywhere else. You don't tune in to hear us ask for money. That's why our goal this summer is simple. Keep the fundraising days to an absolute minimum. Your early support is the engine that powers this station and keeps the fun drives short. Call us now at 818-985-5735 and press option 2. That's 818-985-KPFK, option 2. If you prefer, skip the phone lines entirely. Make your secure, tax-deductible donation online at kpfk.org/donate. Free speech isn't free. It's listener-funded. Keep KPFK strong, independent, and commercial-free. Thank you for your support.
We
other community, a much stranger and wider community.
Support for KPFK is brought to you in part by Catalina's Jazz Club, presenting Omar Sosa and his Cuarteto Americanos on Friday, July 17, 2026. This evening celebrates the release of their brand new debut album, We Are Not the Headliner. Catalina's is located at 6725 Sunset Boulevard West in Hollywood, one block east of Hollywood.